And welcome to our show, Geeks Are Wired Podcast, where we talk about video games, movies, TV, comic books, technology, and TLDR, the Internet of Things. And I'm your host, Bill, with fellow host Anna.
Hi, I'm Anna.
And Alex.
Hi there.
Yay, we made it through, everybody. So we're gonna, there's a lot that happened since we last talked about stuff, but we're gonna start off with Nintendo. Actually, no, I forgot. I even put it on the top of the notes. We're gonna start off with our Patreon page. We have a Patreon page because we're raising money to help support the podcast. We're still keeping it free, but you can get access to it earlier, and you can chat with us in Discord groups. And if we raise enough, we're going to start adding more features. So there's always that.
That's, I got a vouch for the Discord. It's pretty stinking cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We use it as is. Just, you know, we're chatting between stuff that's going on. So you would actually get to join us in our random chats.
You could even go there and just plant news stories you made up, press releases for companies that don't exist, and we'll probably cover it.
Yeah, there, it might just happen, especially if you have a good website that you were able to make it all look all fancy smanchy. All right, so now we'll talk about Nintendo. And they have a Steam and AR cardboard-based product line.
Yeah, so Nintendo just, like, hours ago, actually, I don't think it's, it might even be plural hours at the time of this recording, they introduced a new product line. What time?
It might even be days, depending on when people are listening.
Yeah, yeah, it's probably a couple of days ago for you if you're listening. But as of this recording, it was announced just super recently, this afternoon. Nintendo describes it as a series of DIY kits crafted to work with Nintendo Switch. And they're calling the product line Nintendo Labo. They didn't actually pronounce the name in the video that they demonstrate the product. I'm guessing it's called Labo, but it's basically bits of cardboard that you fold up, and there's accompanying Switch software that uses the Joy-Cons placed into, like, the cardboard apparatus you build to play, like, interactive physical kind of art project-y type games. Like, they've got a game that you put a Joy-Con into this cardboard chicken's head, and you, like, squeeze the chicken. They also have another one that someone puts on, like, this huge, bulky cardboard costume that kind of looks like a robot, and you play a game that looks very much like the tech demo of robot boxing that Nintendo showed off back in, I think, like, 2011 or so, when the Wii U was first announced. So they've got, like, it's a really interesting, like, cross-section of just different, I guess, weird controller accessories and paired games to the Nintendo Switch. And they're selling for relatively cheaply accessories to go with a console, especially first-party accessories. The most expensive one was priced in at $80, and you might say that for a lump of cardboard, that's pretty awful, because it is, but they are really involved huge kits, and on the order of, like, you're putting on an entire robot costume and just assembled together like an IKEA piece of furniture.
Yeah, it did, like, the Switch would tell you how this is going together, because it still comes with software, which, like, this, the Robo kit comes with the Nintendo Labo robot kit software. So that's probably obviously shows you how to build it, how to put everything together. Really simple, you know, kind of like Legos and IKEA, you know, images and, like, look at this, but moving. So you're like, oh, I get how that kind of looked. And the game, I'm assuming, because they showed the game where you could, like, so the Switch itself would probably still be in your console, not for your TV, so you can play along for that one. Not all of them are, but that one.
Yeah, they had one that looks like a weird little house that you put the Switch display into, and then you stick Joy-Cons into, like, weird things that go on the side. I don't know what that one was about. That one was really odd. But it's pretty cool. I think it's like Nintendo is clearly targeting kids with this because one of the features is, look, you can color it. So it's definitely like a weird out there thing. But I think like this is kind of a better idea than you might remember, like during the Wii days when every possible thing that you could fit a Wiimote into had a molded plastic counterpart as just like extra bulk that you can add to a controller to make it feel more immersive. And in this case, they made it cardboard, which is going to be a lot lighter than injection molded plastic. And it's going to be a little bit more disposable and easier to break down, and also offers kids an opportunity to customize and assemble it themselves and color it. I think Nintendo's probably got something that's going to just make kids go nuts.
It's a lot more creative than what they've had in the past, though. So it looks like you get like a flat cardboard and just punch it out and then just kind of build it yourself. I think that's a lot of fun, though. Lots of creativity in it.
I'm kind of wondering if Nintendo is going to release... I guess they wouldn't have to have like specific developer tools for this, but if Nintendo's going to like establish some standard, they'll let third parties come in and make this sort of thing. Because I can see like there's like a cottage industry of STEM or Steam type toys that try to get like some kind of video game related interactivity, and it seems like Nintendo could probably get like some additional content on the Switch by licensing out whatever toolkit they use to design this for their games, or if they'll even like manufacture for third parties. That isn't like anything Nintendo's announced. I'm just wondering, speculating on perhaps that's the future of this Labo product line.
Well, yeah, it was really interesting, like seeing how some of the stuff worked, and you know, like they had the piano, which I still was like, I'm kind of curious how kind of worked together. Some of it makes sense, you know, like they had the motorbike, so obviously, you know, the way the controllers are set up, like the Joy-Cons are slipped in certain spots, so when you pull down triggers on the cardboard, it's actually pushing buttons, and then when you turn the steering wheel, it's because it's turning, you know, the, you know, actual console itself, you know, makes sense. But I also think that this will help, like, have people learn how basic concepts work or how engineering items work.
Yeah, it's kind of cool that they're letting kids build this themselves, because Nintendo could just say, hey, look, we made a big plastic house that you can put your Switch into for $80.
Yeah,
like, I can see like something like that just ending up at in the Goodwill bin in like no time flat. I'm kind of wondering if maybe that's part of the motivation for Nintendo to make something that is inherently fragile like cardboard. Because, I mean, there's no chance that this is going to end up in a Goodwill. Like, someone's going to buy it and there's no resale after it, which you could say that's awful. But I say it's kind of great because I go to Goodwill and I see, like, $5 Wii balance boards and there's a stack of, like, 20 of them. And they're going to go to a landfill someday. And the balance boards will be here after the Martians come blow us up. The cardboard Switch accessories will be gone within a generation. So that's arguably a good thing.
It's recyclable.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, and they also, if you live in San Francisco or New York area or near, and you want to attend the three-hour our Labo Studio hands-on event, and you have a child, that's the other thing, this is for children, or I guess you could buy it yourself as an adult, and you know.
I'm glad they're stipulating that, because there are so many like millennial nerds that work for Kotaku that would just go there and just like write a story about it and not bring like a kid or anything, and they just get a bunch of like bearded guys standing around there, like coloring pieces of cardboard.
Mm-hmm. And I admit, yeah, so that's the good thing. Like I do plan on like checking this out, maybe getting one or something like that. But this, you know, it's definitely for kids or stuff like that, and the 6 to 12. I do feel like they probably should have pushed the age group a little older. Maybe that's something that like maybe high school age kids, because some of this might, yes, it's good to bring in the youth, but I feel like there's some of the, you know, older, or even heck, there's even adults that don't even understand some of these basic concepts.
I don't know, because Nintendo's got like the Switch like made some weird marketing choices early on. If you look at any of the product, boilerplate for their marketing for the Switch when it's first announced. And like even since then, it looks like their demographics have been like millennials and maybe like some Gen Yers. And Gen Y is millennial, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you just named the same one twice.
Anyway, it's mostly 17 to like 30 age group. Like, it's not kids, which is weird for Nintendo.
So you mean Gen X?
Millennials are 30. But yeah, anyway, it's like you look at it, it's like all 17 to like 30 year olds. And I think they've kind of just like breezed past like trying to get kids onto the console because there hasn't been much for them there. And if you look at the games that have come out, they are not really Nintendo's first party games aren't exactly kids games. Mario Odyssey is a really complex game. Mm. Splatoon's a very technical shooter. Breath of the Wild is an extremely technical open world game. So having like a product that is unique among consoles targeted at kids, which kids, their hearts and minds have been won over by iPads completely. There's basically no coming back from that. So if they're going to bring kids back in, it feels like a product like this can offer something that Apple cannot.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if maybe that's like the point, if it's as much like they want to like have this product be a gateway for kids and less as a platform for all ages, which seems exclusionary, but I think Nintendo's trying to like pin down their audiences as best they can.
Or maybe even expand the options. Some like, hey, here's for the adults. Here, this is definitely more for the kids. But back on the location, if you go watch that, you have to sign up at or on the labo.nintendo.com within the show notes before January 21st at midnight Pacific time or until all spots are filled, whichever comes first. And you have to have a Nintendo account.
That's just a weird stipulation. You have to have this free thing that you can sign up for.
Oh, they even go like, you have to have an account. Don't have one? Create one free.
Someone for the marketing department's like, no, we need more signups. Put it, spend money on the ink to print this on the press release so we can get 6 more signups.
Why not?
It doesn't seem like it gives much time for them to get it done, though. Like this event to get it put together.
Oh, for the actual event. I was thinking the signups still.
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
I guess that is pretty quick.
Well, the events, New York is February 2nd and 3rd. San Francisco's is March 2nd and 4th. So they have time for the events, I guess, kind of. But the sign up, I think they're assuming that people are going, this is already closed.
Oh, okay.
For signups.
I do know that like pretty much any Nintendo related event in either of those two cities, because this sounds weird, but Nintendo has a massive retail presence in San Francisco and especially New York. They actually have like Nintendo stores. They've got one in New York. I'm not 100% sure about San Francisco, but in coastal cities, Nintendo has like an artifact of the console wars of the 90s, actually had like strong retail presences on coastal cities. So I think like any event they have, they're going to be well attended to the point that that they won't have room for just like walk-ins to show up and like make a cardboard robot. Like every time Nintendo does like a launch for a product in for the retail store in New York, it's basically they are basically like lining up for weeks.
Yeah. So I guess the timing might be okay. Okay. Let's see. What's the other fun stuff? CES happened last week, but it went all week. So much stuff. We didn't really talk about it last week. We had a guest on. But also, we didn't really want to talk about it because we recorded in the middle of the week, and there was more. So,
what are some highlights? Like, I know what my front runner was, but did you get like a breakdown of like the highlights of CES?
There was a lot of stuff about assistants. So, Madam A. Google Assistant and Samsung is stepping up. Apparently, this has been around, but apparently they're really stepping it up. Is Samsung's Bixby? And they are going to include that in most major Samsung devices. So this is where Samsung is the leader in most home appliances. That means that it's going to be included with your TV, with your washer and dryer, with your refrigerator. And that is one thing that they have over even Apple HomeKit, where, because even though Apple makes like their own stuff, they don't really, they're still within a small group. Google pushes their all their stuff. They put Assistant on everybody else's hardware. Amazon is trying to put make their own little hardware stuff like Apple does, but they're still kind of this little niche. Samsung actually has a decent chance. You could legitimately have a Samsung house and every product is Samsung, but they are not pushing it that way like some of the places are, like how Google and Amazon are arguing with each other and Google pulled YouTube off of the Amazon products, like the Fire. As Samsung is going, well, we have the SmartThings hub. Welcome, still. Like, they still want to work with GE. They still want to work with the Google and the Echo Dots, and or the Echo and everything.
They're going in cars. Introducing, like, the... I don't know what the value equation is of a... walled garden to an Internet of Things platform, because, I mean, there's already, like, open standards for controlling this stuff.
Some.
And like, discrete networks for doing this. So, I like, other than just, like, a thing that's going to have, like, a lot of advertising dollars behind it, like, what does Bixby as an Internet of Things platform offer that, like, Zigbee or Xbee doesn't offer?
Okay, Zigbee...
Like, what are the hot features as a Internet of Things platform?
Okay, Bixby... Okay, so Bixby is... just the assistant,
right? But I mean, if they're just putting like fridges and stuff, like what's it going to do that what's a fridge going to do that like other home automation stuff wouldn't do?
Well, okay, so the fridge can, so it being the assistant, you can still tell it to do things. You just, you know, instead of having to buy a dozen dots throughout your house or having to buy a Google assistant or any of the other assistants and set them in your kitchen, it's now included with your fridge. And 99.9% of smart fridges out there have a screen on them. So now you can tell it to do things. It can show videos on it. It can do whatever. And it can also control other devices. You can set timers. You can do things like this. Because it's just an assistant, an add-on device on top of your smart fridge.
So it's not like Apple HomeKit. It's just Siri for your fridge.
Correct. What is comparable to Apple HomeKit is... Samsung SmartThings. They have a hub that is where the competition would come in, is the differentiation between hubs, needing them, not needing them. Some light bulbs don't need them. Some power switches and some electrical plugs do and don't need them. Some, depending on how you feel, if you just, you know, you have your assistant and you just want, and that was the other thing that was really good is everyone started going, we work with, because places like Home Depot and Lowe's and Office Max are going, market. If you don't market that it works with such and such, we don't care. We will not carry you because you are wasting our employees' time that could be spent somewhere else. But having these hubs, though, also is you can, instead of these just telling the assistant, like, okay, do a few things. And sometimes they have keywords or phrases or things. Like, I have the SmartThings hub. I can tell it to, I don't have to say anything. It just, events happen and it has, and it monitors and it does. And it also is a good way to bring things together. Of all the stuff I have, the only thing that I can't bring in is one random plug that works on the assistants directly that cannot be brought in directly without some side, you know, extra thing. And my Nest, smoke detectors, because Nest is super, you know, doesn't want to integrate. They're one of the bad ones for not wanting to work with anybody else.
They're all kind of the bad ones because, I mean, like, does the, like, Samsung's platform doesn't work with the Nest platform?
No, Samsung wants to. They work with Google Home and they work with a Google Assistant. It's Nest is not letting people use it. Nobody works with Nest.
Yeah, no.
Except for Nest.
I'm just terrified at the idea of not just like not in terms of Ludditism, but we're getting a situation where we're inviting vendor lock-in into all of our homes. And like these temporary alliances, like we've seen with like, for instance, like YouTube and Amazon breaking down, we're at the mercy of just like the emotions of these giant corporations, their perception on what's best for consumers. And we're attaching that to the things that keep like our food, like room safe temperatures. I know there's like a shrinking list of consumer protections that are available to prevent that from happening, but it's just like terrifying that like those are the options. And like, oh, there's these other standards like Zigbee and XB or even X10, which was devised in like the 80s and still works totally fine. And we're handing that over the keys to literally our home to people that the people that are trying to like stab each other in the back.
Okay, so Zigbee and X10, all that, those are just platforms that the information can be traveled across of to the hub or to each other. Because there's Zigbee.
What's the secret sauce of like Apple HomeKit? I mean, it's a protocol like X10 or Zigbee or XB. It's just as accessible from a cloud platform. I mean, it reports back to a device that reports back to the internet, and like. That's the secret sauce, and like that's existed with Open Sarin's like X10 before. I mean, that's all you need is just like a device that can use that existing protocol, and then other devices without having to pay royalties or anything can just use that same protocol. So
some of them are updating, like Z-Wave. They're coming out with an updated version. Or they've come out with an updated version. It's better security, and it's IPv6 because it's similar to what Wi-Fi is, but it has more securities built in. But the nice thing about IPv6 is then you can make a mesh network. So these things end up, you know, your hub only goes so far, so it goes to the next one, which ends up rebroadcasting. Bluetooth is there's new versions of Bluetooth coming out to do the same thing, which is one of them being used.
Bluetooth seems like an overall safer protocol for this, because the idea of like doing this over IP networks just seems like a huge mistake.
Bluetooth ends up falling under the same problems, because they actually, to make sure they're net mesh, they still have to fall under the IPv6 rules.
But
it's not Wi-Fi.
Bluetooth doesn't use like an IP network, though, does it?
Well, no, I'm not saying that it's not an IP network. It is the protocols that it's used.
Yeah, so I mean, if we're using Bluetooth as a protocol, that's maybe a little safer, because the main fear with a lot of the AirNav things, I guess, detractors, is that like that big DNS outage we had last year from light bulbs.
Yeah,
that was because all those were Wi-Fi connected and use IP networks. I mean, that's just not a good protocol for AirNav things devices.
And that is the thing that actually is scaring, that scared a lot of people. The thing about that is those were no name. There was no updates on them. And that's what is going on with a lot of the internet things, is go with like these trusted things. They're constantly pushing out updates. They don't have these back doors. So having a better system or trusted devices ends up making it better. Yes, those cameras and those light bulbs, those rando, it does, you know, they have security flaws built into them, whether purposely or not. And yeah, that can destroy a lot of stuff. The thing I'm more worried about is the updates. You know, your fridge, you know, people have fridges that are literally 30 years old, and locks that are, you know, as old as people's houses on their door. And now we're going to, but our phones are replaced, what, you know, Google says every 2 years they'll support the software updates and 4 years for the security updates. You know, how long is my fridge software going to be updated?
Once the firmware crap out and the fridge no longer has the freezer module, so you'll have to upgrade if you want to have ice cream again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds silly on its face, but I mean, as far as I know, there aren't like consumer protection laws to defend, to like protect from like software updates making your fridge not work anymore.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of that, because I have to admit, I'm not fully into the fridge thing. One, I also, I don't need a screen on my fridge. There's one fridge
value,
I've heard about.
The value, like the value equation for pretty much any of these era of things devices is like it's really hard to like pick out what that is, to suss out what that is. I mean, what would you ask your fridge? Like, how many eggs do I have? Or if you're in the kitchen and you have to repeat it like four times for Bixby to figure out what you're saying, you could just look in your fridge and look at the eggs.
Well, the idea isn't you don't need to look at it. You or while you're at home, you look at while you're away from home. It's like, oh, I forgot to look. Do I have this stuff? But also, your fridge, if it has cameras and LiDAR and all this other stuff built in, what your fridge also goes is, hey, you're running low on milk. Either I'll put it on your shopping list, or if you have something set up, I'll order it from local grocery store, and you'll be set to pick up or be delivered.
That's still not like a I would pay for that to not happen. I don't want appliances doing shopping for me. It's kind of like if you had a self-driving car and your car, like at 2,900 miles, went straight to the dealership, got an oil change, and came back with a bill for synthetic.
So that's actually something else that came. Is this GM ended up announcing they were going to start mass producing self-driving cars to be sold next year. They're just working with Congress so they can get all the ruling and everything else all settled out. And I was thinking, what if your oil change is like your Windows update? The car dealer just goes, hey, let us know when you are not going to be using your car, and we're going to have it drive to the dealer, get its oil changed, and it'll be back to you so you can drive it off in it.
Yeah, it's really spooky. And GM, like in particular, has a bad record for, not being good digital citizens to their customers. OnStar is a really good example where they basically keep the record button all the time on for OnStar, because that's how the technology has to work. Because they want to make sure that they've got like that sort of black box for any paying OnStar customers. Some security advocates have speculated that they probably keep the record button on even if you aren't a paying customer, but who knows? It's kind of the same territory as like digital assistants, like with the Amazon Echo, that if it can happen, it probably is happening.
So also the same thing like with our phones, because Google and Siri are totally pretty much
right. They'd have to do the work of turning it off and not bother collecting the data. And in an economy where data is like a valuable commodity, it's hard to imagine a world that isn't being like discreetly collected in some way. Anyway, I'm going to hang on to my 99 GMC Sonoma for a while. I'm hoping that holds out till we exhaust all of our fossil fuel reserves, which will probably happen about 100 years from now.
All right. Oh, so I was looking at some of the protocols and everything with Bluetooth. It's its own special encapsulation, plus it's multi-channel adaptive protocol. So there's a lot of stuff. Z-Wave is a low energy radio wave. Communicate between appliances and everything.
Radio seems like such a better idea for that. For Z-Wave, using just like straight up radio to send information from one device to another. Because I can't imagine a situation where you have to actually send packets.
Yeah, you can easily send 100 meters away over the 800 to 900 megahertz frequency range.
That's another thing that drives me wild. The 2.4 gigahertz spectrum has less range than the 800 and 900 megahertz spectrum.
Oh yeah, I thought that was quite entertaining, because I started looking at all these devices, bringing them, trying to make them maybe not butt heads as much, or maybe trying to make them work together. So I have a Z-Wave. I have a Wi-Fi. I think that's all I got at the moment. I haven't actually brought in a Bluetooth yet. I haven't brought in any of the others. But like, I'm almost thinking I want to stick with one thing. Like this, if the Z-Wave knew it would, there's so many, they can work together to make the overall experience better. So, at the edge of my house, we have issues with Wi-Fi. The idea of having issues with Wi-Fi at the edge of your house, I don't need a Z-Wave device to be at the edge of the house. And yes, it literally only needs to be, say, one or zero. And especially when there's like stuff at farmers that can have like, hey, is my ground wet or not? And that stuff can travel 40 miles. That little it's another frequency. It can travel 40 miles.
Yeah, that's kind of the benefit of using radio for a device like that. You don't have to like rely on physical networks that can carry carry a TCP/IP network. You can basically just use like old school radio communications and send data that way. I mean, you could I guess you could say, "Oh no, it's a security vulnerability." But I mean, at that point, the security vulnerability isn't there on an IP network that's connected to your home network. The security vulnerability is they can turn your lights off and on.
Okay, I probably should walk away from all my, you know, assistants and so forth. But did you get to see anything in CES?
I haven't.
Okay. All right, Alex. What did you think?
My all-time favorite thing from CES was Kodak announced a new cryptocurrency called Kodak Coin. And they have their own line of miners to produce Kodak Coin. I'll give you a second to grab your sides from all of your laughing, because actually it is a real thing. And they showed a picture of the box. It looks like a standard Kodak, it looks like a standard Bitcoin miner, except on the side it says Kodak Cash Miner. And yes, cash is spelled with a K. So yeah, the cryptocurrency trend is like an investment opportunity, has been a big deal over like the last couple of months, with Bitcoin climbing price to $20,000 or close to $20,000. And, I figured, oh, this is silly. There's no way Kodak's stocks climbed after this. And, no, that they definitely jumped up by like the highest they've been in about 4 years. And I looked today and they're still hanging on there. So like for about the last about week or so, they've been a lot higher than they have been like the previous few years, because they announced a shoebox that will mine a fake money they invented. So I decided to, I was kind of wondering how long that would hold up. So how long that would hold up. Cause overall, I feel like Bitcoin's kind of a bubble that's going to burst. So I decided to take a look at Bitcoin today, and Bitcoin has dropped in value since its all-time high of $20,000. It has dropped by 49%. So it's back down to $10,000 where it was 2 months ago. That seems kind of weird that there's like all this attention given to this currency that's essentially a math problem as the intrinsic value of the currency. So I thought that was kind of a volatile, a volatile currency, even though it has less intrinsic value than a baseball card does. So I decided to take a look at some historically volatile currencies, and I put together a quiz for us that you can join along with. The Volatile Currency Price is Right. Let's take advantage of living in an empire-backed economy that speculated for a month over math problems as currencies. Can you guess which of these currencies has dropped more than Bitcoin from its high point over the course of this month, compared to these currencies I'm going to start reading off over the last 2 years? So again, that comparison is Bitcoin has fluctuated from its all-time high of $20,000 down to $10,000 as of today. And that happened in the course of a month. I'm going to compare it to some currencies over the last 2 years and their all-time high compared to today. And it's Bill and Anna's job to determine if these currencies have dropped less than Bitcoin or they've dropped more than Bitcoin over the course of 2 years compared to Bitcoin's month.
You got that? You ready?
So the way this game works is you have to tell me if you think the currency that I read off has dropped more or less than Bitcoin over the last 2 years.
Percentage-wise?
You don't have to give
overall.
Me a number, just more or less. It's like, I guess it's more like that old game show Card Sharks, just more or less.
Okay, and our listeners can play along too.
If you win, write into the show at geekserwired@gmail.com and let us know how you scored.
Or they can even call us at 801-896-GEEK.
Make sure to play live. And don't give any context for your answer. Just say hi, low, hi, or whatever. Okay,
or you could pause the podcast. It is an audio. Yes. They can pause it.
They could. You'll have a moment to decide which one you think it is. So the first currency is the Russian ruble. Over the last few years, Russia has had to depend on the U.S. for its wheat supply. For actually decades, it's had to do that off and on. Recently, it's got its wheat. It's actually been able to export wheat. So Russia's been doing pretty good there recently. But also, like in the previous decade, Russia had to rely on dollars for its currency because of the collapse of their government the decade before. Russia's current largest export is oil. If you've been paying attention to oil prices, that might be a hint. But what do you guys think? Do you think the Russian ruble has dropped more or less than Bitcoin over the last 2 years?
I think it's dropped less than Bitcoin.
I have to concur.
You are correct.
I feel like that
the Russian ruble has only dropped 1% from its high over the last 2 years. Just 1%. Okay, the
1 point each. Yay.
What's that?
Bill and I are doing well.
That's one for one. So far, you're doing pretty good. There's three left though, so let's see if you can hang on to your score. The next one is the Syrian pound. Syria has endured civil war for the past 6 years with hundreds of factions, including the current Assad government, ISIS, and the leftist YPG coalition. Do you think the Syrian pound has decreased in value more over the last 2 years or less than Bitcoin over the last 2 years?
On that one, I'd like to say that it's more because I think that there's a lot going on there.
I should go first from now on. I was going to say more also.
Both of you are correct. It has dropped 64% from its high over the last 2 years. So, yeah, it's pretty rough in Syria if you weren't paying attention. Okay, the next one, the Afghani. The U.S. recently dropped the largest non-nuclear explosive device in its arsenal on this country. It's also been at war for the last 3 decades against the most powerful armies in human history. Do you think the Afghani has dropped more or less in the last 2 years as compared to Bitcoin over the last month? Whoa, dropped something.
Ew, this one's hard because, like,
I know.
Especially if they have been in war for that long. It's possible that they haven't really changed all that much. So,
okay, I'm gonna go first this time.
Okay,
I'm gonna say less than Bitcoin.
That's what I wanted to say too. Is less than Bitcoin.
You guys are acing this so far. It has dropped less. It has only dropped 6% from its all-time high,
which is good because I actually have Afghan currency. I'm glad it's
not holding
terrible.
Its value. All right, and the last one. Let's see if you can do this 4 for 4. The Venezuelan Bolivar. The population of Venezuela has been rising due to lack of food, inflation of food pricing, and a gross drop in the standard of living. The U.S. has spent millions pushing a coup to overthrow Venezuela's government, and Venezuela is the biggest exporter of oil in the Western Hemisphere. However, the largest consumer of oil in the same hemisphere has placed sanctions that hamstring this OPEC nation's ability to sell to them. Do you think the Venezuelan Bolivar has dropped more or less than Bitcoin? This is a tough one.
I know. I'm going to go more. That's my choice.
Oh, this is difficult too, because
there was a lot of good information there. And I was kind of thinking.
I got a lot of this information from the CIA World Factbook, except for the U.S. spending millions on pushing a coup to overthrow their government. They didn't put that part in there for some reason.
I wonder why.
I don't know, because like that, just knowing whether or not it's within the last just little bit.
Well, the last 2 years, yeah. Depending on it could have.
Or if it's been just a constant issue like all along. So I think I might actually side with Bill.
Oh, okay. Say more. I was like, are we going to disagree?
let's
all right,
do
we're both
more.
Going more. We're more.
Yes, we're both
it's
more.
Dropped less. The drop was 37%. It was a close one. It was within about 15%. So
yeah, I was like, so.
So yeah, right. I guess the lesson here is don't put your life savings into Bitcoin. It's probably not a good idea.
Or
maybe put it into rubles, because that's a much safer bet than Bitcoin is.
Yes. All right. That was a fun game show.
I feel dirty after looking up all those stats. I'm like, man, this is really a bummer. Also, there's really there's really bad data on Cuban pesos, North Korea's currency. Yeah, really? there's bad data on the exchange rate for Cuban pesos and the whoever North Korea's currency is, and the Zimbabwean dollar. Like, there just isn't good data on it. Also, Iran's currency too. It's got really bad data as well. Like, when we looked at XE.com, it was just like a flat line.
This hasn't changed.
I think they just do that if they don't have data points for it.
Yeah, I can see that. All right. Well, how about, would this make you feel better? You know, with investing in currencies, how about the robots are taking your jobs?
I feel marginally better.
Okay. So there is a Kickstarter by a robot that's writing a book, and this is its second Kickstarter. Apparently this one, it's only like halfway there. It still has like, what was it? 17 days to 15 days. It has 15 days as of this recording to go. And so it'll close February 2nd at 5:01 PM Mountain Standard Time. So
halfway there.
Yeah, halfway there. So we get, it's not too bad.
So if you ever wanted a book written by a computer instead of a person, this one's for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Last time they made a little toy. They designed a toy. This time they're making a book. So it's expanding its horizon of taking your job.
I point this out before we hopped on the pod, but I feel like if you're going to make an AI to do anything on Kickstarter, you should make an AI that makes Kickstarters that will meet the goal. I think getting fun an AI to getting fun on Kickstarter might be a recipe for success compared to the actual end product being made by an AI. Just saying, there's a lot of Kickstarters that don't get funded, so I mean there might be an opportunity there for an enterprising AI researcher.
Yeah, that would not be bad. I do enjoy this. There it is. If you donate, because you can get the book at $15. So, you know, it's pretty decent for, it's a kid's book. It's fairly simple. It looks more like it's a children's book. But at $45, you can get a signed copy. The computer will sign the book for you.
Does it illustrate along with writing the book? If it's doing it for a children's book, I know that they probably would illustrate like with pictures, right?
Well, okay, there is an illustrator, so there's probably a human doing the illustration, because there's the money is going towards the illustrator's commission, shipping costs, backers rewards, and Kickstarter fees. Production and shipping costs. So in other words, they're for people doing work and for the physical product and the 95% that Kickstarter takes off the top. No, it's okay. Probably not that bad.
But the robot writes the story.
The robot writes the story. And then the robot's name, or I guess it's Luna. They said this is Luna's second Kickstarter. Yes, Luna. So I guess this is a story about itself. It's a self. Yeah, there's it's a little toy for its first one, or its first campaign.
So just kind of an autobiography from the robot,
I guess, or what it wished it was.
Where are you reading? That's a AI that wrote it. Because I read written by the bots, and it says in About Us, Jen and Tony Bott, also known as the Bots, are a husband and wife duo from Fort Thomas, Kentucky.
Oh. Darn, this is not nearly as interesting as I thought it was. Maybe.
Well, it might be a lady married to a robot. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, that's why it seemed like, you know, with the... social, the bot known as. I might be off. This might not be nearly as cool as I
thought.
I like
the thought experiment of a children's book written by a robot. There's some language in here that makes it really seem like that's what they're selling.
Yeah, you're right. Maybe that's why I...
Because it says like written by the bots, illustrated by 64 colors, which kind of sound like which sound very much like CS Master thesis project for making an AI.
Now I gotta go find a Kickstarter actually made by a bot.
I'm sure there has been one. Actually, there have been books on Amazon written by AIs.
Ooh, there we go.
Doing live fact checking.
Now there we go. We don't have music to go with our stuff, so we'll just go like do do do. Wait, that's copyright.
Yeah, don't hum too many bars from that song from that thar game show. That an AI actually won at and beat Ken Jennings. Actually, did it beat Ken Jennings?
Yeah, because he even said that he accepts the defeat from his new AI overlords.
He didn't have to say that.
He totally did, though.
That's like saying I accept my defeat from a fat nerd with a laptop with Google. What if we find out that's all that Watson is? It's just like some guy sweating in a box with a laptop. It's like a 6-year-old Gateway laptop that has like Clippy permanently installed. He can't remove it. And like YouTube's blocked, all I can do is read Wikipedia, and then it's like old articles from the Encarta Encyclopedia.
It keeps on saying, "It looks like you're trying to make a sentence. Would you like some help?"
You held down the shift key for 6 seconds. Would you like your keyboard to stop working? Okay.
Right, I'm most impressed with this Kickstarter.
And oh, I that can't might find be why they're only half.
I put it. Yeah, maybe. Everyone was like, "Hey," and they're like, "Oh."
I stand by my original assessment. And like, if you want to make what they should do instead of making an AI that makes things, if anyone's so inclined to start a Kickstarter around that concept, they should make an AI that makes Kickstarters get successfully funded. Which makes me think maybe I should start an Indiegogo campaign to fund the creation of an AI that makes Kickstarters that get funded, and then just take the money and never do anything with it. Because you don't need a prototype for Indiegogo.
Ah. Well, there you go.
Swish. Nothing but net.
Go. Well, that'll be in the show notes, though, because it was interesting for a moment. We'll go with the Magic Leap AR Goggles.
Yeah, this is a wild one.
The one
there's a Rolling Stone article a really long Rolling Stone article on it. You should check it out or at least skim it if you are the listener. But there's been this AR product that is supposed to compete with Microsoft HoloLens or Microsoft Holo, and it was announced I think like about 2-3 years ago, something like that. And everyone's like, "Oh, it's vaporware." Some startup said they made something lighter weight than HoloLens. This is clearly never going to come out. And they actually demoed a product to like a functional prototype that was very small compared to HoloLens to a Rolling Stone writer. And apparently it does what it says on the tin. It's a smaller version of HoloLens with a bigger display field, which is pretty good. I mean, definitely check it out. I don't know if it's ever going to come to retail because it is such a tiny company and they aren't going to have like, how do you distribute something that's that expensive and you're such a tiny studio, but it's actually like good technology. The weird feature that they describe in it is that caught my eye was this thing called light field photonics, which sounds like enriched flavor nodules or something like that. It sounds like a fancy way to dress up the word camera, but that's actually a thing. There's like a weird type of CMOS sensor that doesn't render light. using like a typical CMOS sensor, and just like different display values on the surface of a CMOS, there's some voodoo that can actually sense the shading, the amount of light at different depths ahead of the lens, which doesn't sound like it's an important detail. But if you're a human person that has two eyeballs in your head and you're trying to have an augmented reality experience and there's like a goblin in the room with you, you can't just use the lighting that a camera can pick up. You'd have to use the lighting for the area the goblin is standing in. And if they use light field photonics, it's actually able to do that and say, we need this amount of shading because it's 3 feet away from the person. And as far as I know, Microsoft HoloLens just fakes that experience with software. And this thing actually has hardware to determine the amount of shading for stuff at different distances. And it can even use this technology to like for depth perception and actually map out the room in three-dimensional space. It's really cool tech. They haven't like made firm promises on when it's coming to market or any of the APIs are coming out. But the fact that the hardware exists means that AR is a little more trivial to implement now.
The original one definitely huge and weird. What they're showing, is that what they actually have? Is what they were showing?
I don't think so. I think the weird wooden thing was the first prototype that they made. They've got another one now that you also look like the dude on the cover of System Shock 1.
Okay, so that one is actually like it's a little bit sleeker looking. The little gray goggles with the
there's like a thing that looks like an MP3 player from like the early 2000s that you clip to your belt.
Yeah,
that's like supposed to be like the final version that comes out.
Oh, so they don't actually have that one. That's just kind of a.
I actually don't remember specifically from the Rolling Stone article. It goes in like narrative detail, but I don't think they actually were allowed to take pictures of the products.
Okay. Yeah, I think I did read this when you first posted it.
Yeah, this is from a couple of weeks ago. It's been a little while, but the nice thing about the Stone article, if you're like, no pictures, that's lame. The nice thing about the Rolling Stone article is that they describe how the technology works. They have like stuff from Magic Leap's press kit for the final version of the goggles. But the important part is where they describe how the technology functions. That's kind of the important part, because otherwise if we ever have AR, it's going to be like a Nintendo 3DS type experience where you've just got like a thing that's floating in space ahead of you instead of this other experience where it looks like something is part of the room based on the way light hits it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of like Pokemon Go and all that.
Yeah. Cause I mean, that just looks like a 3D thing on top of a camera. But this could be a game changer. I'm still a little pessimistic that this will come to market as is, and they'll probably get bought up by Google or Samsung or somebody who wants to get into AR,
or at least more into AR, because Google has tried and they end up turning apparently have it around, but then they turned their camera into the Pixel phones.
Yeah. So who knows? And the upside is we got a cool piece of concept art out of it, because you legitimately do look like the guy from Deus Ex or System Shock 1.
I did like what the one picture was like. It's just shows somebody just like chatting with somebody else. I'm like, yeah, I don't know if I could actually like. They don't look terrible compared to a lot of things, but they definitely don't look like I'd wear this on a regular basis.
They definitely don't look like a Bluetooth in your ear tied to your head. At least you look like a guy who's cosplaying instead of somebody who's like might be watching VR porn. Exciting stuff.
I know. As Ted says, what an exciting time to be alive. Well, there's still so much. I don't know. But I think the CES stuff.
Yeah, I think we can probably put. I mean, the highlights for CES were just, like I said, Internet Things stuff. GM announcing that they're going to do some shady stuff in Congress to make sure that they our first to market self-driving cars, and
at least the American market.
Yeah, and then Kodak announcing that they are going to contribute to the cryptocurrency hysteria. It wasn't a good CES. There's a lot there, but it's just nothing that like would excite consumers.
Yeah, well, also things that may not be actually be coming out, kind of like the television. You know how you can have the
Samsung made their like television that you can like stretch.
Oh, I didn't think I would notice that one. I was talking about the one that it, you know how people have projectors that the thing drops down out of the ceiling and then the thing projects on it. There's another one that you set on the floor and it comes up, but it's not projected on. The screen is the entire thing. So it's like a really, really thin television.
That's kind of a smart idea.
That rolls up.
To have laser projectors embedded into a screen like that. Because there's no reason they can't do that.
Well, the thing is an 85-inch 8K TV.
That's a heck of a laser projector.
Well, because that like you're not project actually no because the screen itself is the TV. It's not you're being projected onto it.
Okay, so it's just a flexible display then. It's not a projector.
Oh, correct.
That's super weird. I wonder why they do that other than just it's going to be expensive and some guy in Jackson will buy it.
That or the fact that you know it's kind of like the 80s where you know you don't need to build your entire room around your TV. You just like this thing goes away and you have a really cool piece of art or you can do something else with it. You know, remember the 80s where you like had these cabinets that you would hide the TV in?
All those Zeniths out there that have like the big hutch doors on them.
Yep.
It's always Zenith. Like Zenith just want you to never see the thing they made. They're just ashamed by the televisions. Like, put it in a box, don't look at it.
We're not that cool. Just watch us.
Actually, what Zenith should do is they should announce a cryptocurrency, and they could be back to making televisions and hutches.
There you go. And Polaroid. There you go. Maybe Blockbusters should get back in on this.
Why not have Blockbuster coin? Blockbuster bucks.
There you go.
I want the original like Polaroid cameras. Those were good.
Those have kind of made a comeback in like some small way. Like they don't have like the cool aesthetic, rainbow aesthetic that they used to have. But like they even make like I think even like a thing that you can hook, like stick your phone into, and it's more or less just like a Polaroid camera like held that holds your phone steady, and you can sort of use it like a weird printer for phone images. I think that's kind of cool. I mean, the Polaroid film is like hella expensive, but I mean, like, how many people like print a lot of pictures anymore?
Well, the other stuff I was saying is it prints it out, but you also can edit it nowadays. So you have the printer, but you also can like pretty much I guess that's Fuji Polaroid Originals. So it'll print it out, but you also can like edit it like it's a, Snapchat filter.
So you put like your Polaroid filter, your Instagram Polaroid filter on things that are printed off of Polaroid. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, like if it's Polaroid, yeah, because it's probably just a printer really with as small as things now are nowadays.
They frame it with the Polaroid white square. But then they have to fit the aspect ratio of the like the photo area of a Polaroid image. So it's just that white frame inset into an actual Polaroid snapshot.
Mm-hmm.
You have like a 1 inch by 1.5 inch photo. And then just all frame. Just nothing but frame outside.
Oh no, it might be actually some print paper with the I don't know. I'd have to look at it because you still can write on it and all that. So it might not be the white actually might still be paper, but only the picture part is actually. So it only prints on that.
I'm kind of glad that we as a society decided that getting film developed and getting photo prints. I mean, that's kind of cool. But the only thing that consumers actually want is like Polaroids because it's kind of just like a cool novelty thing. Even if you've never had to wait for like getting photos developed or in my case, having to develop photos yourself. It's just kind of a cool concept that you can have this thing that when you first look at, there's no picture. And then gradually over time, just chemicals in like a little pouch, make a photo. It's kind of like, it's kind of like the fun of like sea monkeys every time you take a photo.
No, oh, so but they're not too bad. But we now we probably should wrap up the podcast. So we'll go with famous last words.
Alex. Buy up Kodak coin. It's going to be a huge hit.
I like Polaroids, the instant film.
The name of this episode is Blockbuster Bucks.